Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Cormac O'Hara. As the UK struggles with a political checkmate, we get the latest in the plot to topple Theresa May and ask if her Brexit plan still stinks enough for MPs to reject it and face the cliff edge. And a buoyant Fine Gael claims it's election ready at its Ardèche. Can the party convince you to stretch its reign of power into a decade? First the news, read by Susan Jackson. Gurmila Mogad, Susan Jackson. I'm joined in studio by Lisa Chambers of Fianna Fáil, the spokesperson on Brexit, Ivana Bacik, a Labour senator, Professor Gary Murphy is of the Department of Law and Government in DCU, and Daniel McConnell is political editor with the Irish Examiner. Will be joined shortly from the City West on satellite Minister Joe McHugh, Minister for Education. But can I ask you first, I think it's 23 Tories who have publicly declared at this point and they're demanding a no-confidence vote in Theresa May. Is she, I wonder, Gary Murphy, a dead woman walking? Because whether the big beasts of the Tory party take her down or whether she fails in her Brexit deal parliamentary vote, I wonder, are her days numbered, do you reckon?
Well, I'm not sure they are. First of all, she's extraordinarily resilient and has been extraordinarily resilient since she took the leadership after David Cameron, the great boy wonder of British politics, resigned after the fatuity of calling the referendum. A referendum, in my view, was no need to call at all, and basically passed over Parliament to do so in a kind of a clever move that spectacularly backfired, and we're still waiting for his memoirs.
But ever since then,
I think Theresa May has had an extraordinarily difficult job, as have prime ministers way back since Margaret Thatcher on the far right, because there is this constant rump of about, you say 25, no, up to 50 perhaps, who want a fantasy Brexit, which simply doesn't exist. I think there might be quite a large rump in the middle that will keep Theresa May in power in the Tory party. But the big problem, of course, is can she get this deal through Parliament? And with Labour saying that they're not going to support her, although maybe a dozen Remainers might vote for this deal, I think we're in for a very difficult situation.
Yeah, Daniel, we'll go to London in just a second, but there seems to be a rump of people who will support her in the party in the event of a no-confidence vote, but who don't want her deal. So it's kind of checkmate, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I certainly think, you know, what we saw was the initial flurry of the Brexiteers coming out, the Jacob Rees-Moggs, the Boris Johnsons, you know, crying foul, saying that this, you know, has turned Britain into a vassal state, you know, it's treachery of the highest order, so on and so forth. You know, the way they were going on, you would have assumed by Wednesday the 48 people would have been out and it all would have been done and dusted. And, you know, the hype and the hysteria in Westminster was almost ridiculous, you know, over the last few days. I agree with Gary. I think Theresa May has performed magnificently, not only in the last week, but over the last two odd years, you know, dealt an impossible hand by her own party, you know, divisions that have gone back 30, 40 years in relation to it. You know, as I'm writing this morning, I mean, if the Tory party actually woke up and realised if they want a strong leader who can actually do a job, get something real, they have it in Theresa May and they should just get on with it and leave her alone.
She's doing the job they don't want. I'm going to the hacks before I go to the politicians. John Rintoul, chief political commentator with The Independent, joins us from London. Is the heave going to happen, John? You're very welcome to the programme.
I'm not sure that it is, but it is possible that the required number of letters calling for a vote of no confidence have already gone in, and the chair of the 1922 committee is waiting until Monday, when Parliament is sitting again, before he makes the announcement. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if they haven't actually got the 48 letters. I don't think it matters too much either way, because I think in a way, if they have a vote of confidence, then that will strengthen her, because I think she'll win it. And it means that they won't be able to come after her again at her point of maximum weakness, which is when she's trying to get the deal through Parliament.
So he's possibly waiting until Monday. So he may be informing her privately today or tomorrow that the deal is done.
Well, that's a speculation that was running around Westminster yesterday, was that the reason that some of the Conservative whips had been called back to Westminster on a Friday, which is a non-sitting day, was because Sir Graham Brady had, out of courtesy, let number 10 know that he was going to be making this announcement. But I mean, this is all mad speculation.
Everything is mad at the moment, John.
But as I say, the important point is not, I don't think, the issue of the vote of confidence. The important point is whether she can get the Brexit deal through the House of Commons.
Talk to me about the rumours that are circulating, that we're picking them up here, that there may be something in the offing in terms of a deal with Jeremy Corbyn, as in, you vote for this and I'll give you something that you want. Is there any truth in that? What is it?
Well, I see James Forsyth of the Spectator has written in the Sun that the only way she can get the deal through is to promise to stand down after we leave the EU, which because that would buy off her supporters. And then, you know, a colleague of mine has suggested in The Independent that, you know, she should offer Jeremy Corbyn a general election after we leave the EU in return for Labour votes to get the deal through. I think both of those are rather extreme possibilities, but they do. I mean, there is a truth there that she does need to. She does need to make an offer to Labour MPs in particular, because she's going to need an awful lot of Labour votes to offset the rebellion on her own side.
Well, without doubt. And I watched the debate in the Commons, I think, on Wednesday.
Thursday, was it?
I used in the banner at the very start of the programme that I just wondered, will Theresa May's deal, will it still stink to high heaven for the MPs? Because that's what came across from that debate. Is there any chance at all of this deal passing?
Yes. Oh, yes, there is. Very much so. Because, I mean, Labour, you know, all the opposition MPs, Labour, SNP and Liberal Democrats, they say they're not going to vote for it because, you know, they want some kind of better deal, or they want to stop Brexit altogether. But, I mean, once it becomes obvious that there is no better deal that is available and that they can't stop Brexit, they can't delay they can't delay our departure, which is what they'd like to do in order to hold a referendum. Once those options are taken off the table, then the only options that remain are doing the deal or leaving without a deal. Now, I cannot believe that the vast majority of Labour MPs are going to vote for Britain to leave the EU without a deal, with all the economic disruption and costs that would involve on March the 29th.
Okay, well, that's what she's hoping for, I suppose. Look, John Rintoul, thank you very much indeed for making it so clear for us. anyway, Lisa Chambers of Fianna Fáil, you're there, the party's Brexit spokesperson. Once it becomes obvious, as is John Rintoul, that they won't get a better deal, some of them may turn and vote in favour of this deal. How likely is that, in your opinion?
I mean, it's possible. You know, I mean, I know that this morning Graham Brady, who's the chair of the 1922 committee, there seems to be some suggestion that we may have the 48 numbers to trigger the no confidence vote in Theresa May, but they need 158 to vote for it then to actually succeed. So that's quite a difference in numbers. Labour were quite strong. When they first saw the draft text, Keir Starmer was straight out to say, it does not meet with our standards, we will not be voting for it. The DUP have said they will not be voting for it. Now, I know that Michael Gove has now rolled in behind the Prime Minister and said he'll support her and has confidence in her. But it's reported that when he was offered the Brexit Secretary position, which has now gone to Stephen Barclay, that he said, well, I'll take the job as long as I can renegotiate the deal. And then you have the Taoiseach just saying that the deal is not up for renegotiation. So is it a draft agreement or is it the final agreement? We don't actually know.
Is there time to renegotiate?
Well, I think from the European Union's perspective, I think they've actually come as far as they can go. I think there's been a huge amount of compromise.
Well,
there
was
a
big where?
Well, I'll tell you where. There was a big concession given by Barnier and his team to give the UK-wide customs union. That was initially rejected because that was sought by the British Prime Minister. That was kind of her key push. Initially, Barnier said, no, we're not doing that. Other member states very concerned that that would give them an unlevel playing field, because here they are getting free access to the market. They could potentially produce goods at a lower cost, less regulation, lower standards, and have that competitive advantage. Now, how they got around that, there's actually an annex to that customs union in the text that basically has a load of rules the UK have to abide by to get this customs union, which are effectively single market rules. But that's kind of a backdoor to the single market.
To sell the deal, Theresa May said in the House of Commons, we're out of the customs union, we're out of the single market.
She also said this is not the final deal. in her first speech to the Commons after her 5-hour marathon long cabinet meeting, she actually said this is not the final deal. The Taoiseach here is saying it is the final deal. Barnier hasn't said whether it is or not. So we don't know, is this draft text going to be renegotiated, amended a little bit? Can it be made palatable to Labour? Because Labour has said in its current form they will not support.
Or is it double speak, Ivana Bacic?
On the numbers, she cannot get it over the line without Labour votes. That is an absolute fact.
Labour is being driven mental by this double speak, and that's what Jacob Rees-Mogg made a point of saying in his address in Westminster in the Commons on Thursday. They don't know where they stand with her, isn't that right?
Well, I don't think many people know where Britain stands as an entity at all, and whether and of course the Tory party are utterly disunited as well. So I think the lack of clarity is what's most apparent from all of the discussion and the debate. And when one peels back all of that, one sees just a singular lack of clarity about it. What stands out, of course, is that this agreement, which of course is headed draft agreement, as you say, Lisa, but which Michel Barnier and others have said won't be, or it seems they're saying won't be renegotiated. And this is as far as they're prepared to go. And certainly it's very positive. Well, not positive, because nothing about Brexit is positive for Ireland. But it's as good a deal, I suspect, as Ireland and Northern Ireland will get, even if the DUP don't see it that way. But what's striking about it is just the extraordinary complexity of the arrangements that have to be negotiated. People have talked about a divorce, but this isn't just a divorce. This is a messy divorce with multiple properties and children and custody, where every item has been contentious. If you look at famously the 585 pages, you just see just how many specific issues have to be negotiated and have to be haggled over.
And the EU won on an awful lot of them. And I think that's a point that Fianna Fáil made when the deal was struck. Minister Joe McHugh, and I don't want to put words in Lisa Chambers' mouth, but out ye were straight away that evening saying, look at what we got. Was it appropriate, I wonder?
I actually think it went too far, because it was one particular comment that I thought was just at the time. When you consider that Theresa May, the context is so important, a 5-hour cabinet meeting where she really took it in the neck. We know this. She was heading into the Commons the next day where she said herself, we are approaching really challenging and difficult times. She knew what she was heading into. And I think for our own Taoiseach to say, we have gotten a better backstop than we got last December that night, I just thought it was a step too far.
Minister Joe McHugh, was that appropriate?
Look, let's be very clear about what happened on Wednesday. There was a collective cabinet decision deciding on an agreement between the United Kingdom and the European Union. Obviously, we as a government welcomed the factors that affected Ireland directly and indirectly. And from the work that's been going into this at both a civil servant level, at an all-European level, at a government level, you do have to acknowledge every step of the way. So we had an opportunity on Wednesday, number one, to welcome the agreement and acknowledge the agreement, and number two, to welcome and acknowledge the fact that there's collective cabinet approval. Obviously, even on Wednesday night, and we were in discussions with each other, we were hearing rumours that there were going to be potential resignations. So we were fully aware about the difficulties of this, the possible challenges in the following morning. But we're in a space now.
What a better backstop. Was that appropriate?
2 to 3 weeks.
It was like a red flag to the bull of the Unionist Party, wasn't it?
Well, look, let's be very clear what the Irish people's strategic interest was from the minute that this Brexit agreement or this Brexit referendum happened. We obviously regretted that it happened in the first place. Secondly, we accepted the democratic right of the people, but we also put out full front and in people's minds that there was a democratic decision made on the island of Ireland, both north and south, for the Good Friday Agreement. So at all times, it was the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement. It was the specifics of the Good Friday Agreement in all its parts. So when you get an agreement which ensures there'll be no hard border, I certainly don't.
Really important to point out, first and foremost, this deal has not been ratified. We don't have a deal across the line. And Joe, I'd ask you to respond directly to your former colleague, who was a senior minister in a Fine Gael government, Jacinda Creighton, European Affairs Minister, who tweeted, "The great victory for Dublin narrative across comms and media last night was ill-judged, in my opinion." entirely premature and unhelpful. I think the government has negotiated impeccably, but gives into temptation to oversell steps in the process.
Sure,
so this is somebody.
Just to
respond to that, I mean, I do think we have to be cautious and cognizant of what is happening in terms of Theresa May and needing that space. Well, the Taoiseach himself said that the UK government needs space to get
Daniel,
this across the line.
Before we come back to the
on two fronts. One, had the Irish government not gotten everything in this agreement, you, Lisa, and your other opposition colleagues would be screaming down the barrel saying the government had capitulated, given way and all the rest of it. So I think the government was right to emphasise the success that it had made. Two, I was there at the press conference that the Taoiseach gave. It was one remark at the end of the press conference. He was asked about the mood on the day. He said, if satisfactory. Two, he said, this is one of the better days in politics. And he overall said that the deal was satisfactory.
Like, and a better backstop.
Yeah, like he did say about the better backstop, but I think that was in relation to Martina Fitzgerald's question around, is it, you know, around the bulletproof aspect, as had been criticised, you know, his use of language last December.
Should there have been a press conference at all?
Of course there should have been. Because
be a press conference.
I mean, the one thing that struck me in probably the leakiest government I've ever seen since I've been reporting on politics, they were actually able to show a bit of discipline on Wednesday and lock it down for about 5 or 6 hours.
They show discipline to have it locked down for 5 or 6 hours is exactly
people,
my point. Sorry. Just to make my point before you come back in. Last December, we had a difficulty because the backstop was oversold last December, and we spent almost a year trying to get something negotiated. The very first point I made when I responded to the text was, this is extremely welcome. It represents a step towards a potential deal, and we need to give the UK government space to try and get that across the line. The only point I was making about saying we've got a better backstop now than we got last December
is that
we should have just minded our P's and Q's and just calm down a small bit, relax, take the time.
But people have been very concerned about the backstop since last December because of the fear that it wasn't worth the paper it was written on.
Yes.
And I wrote about that critically amongst other people at the time. And so here we are 11 months later, and I think the Taoiseach was quite right. And I've been critical of the Taoiseach on lots of other things, but I think he's quite right to emphasise that it is a better deal for Ireland. What's he supposed to say? Keep quiet? It's not the Taoiseach's fault that there is internal strife in the Tory party and also in the Labour party.
The DUP party are saying that we believe that the Taoiseach's ulterior motive is a united Ireland, that he's trying to use this to push a united...
But the only people who think that the Taoiseach's ulterior motive is a united Ireland, in my view, are the DUP.
The DUP have their own issues on this, and I don't think they were ever going to be pleased. The point I was making is that she had come out of a 5-hour cabinet meeting.
Gareth
and the commentary,
10-hour cabinet meeting. I'm not convinced 5-hour
business is
a big deal at all.
That period between that cabinet meeting and the House of Commons the following day, the language, the backstop had been such a contentious issue that at that point in time, to say we have gotten a better deal than last time.
Okay, but they were annoyed, Lisa.
The timing of that was ill-judged. And that was actually, it wasn't just Fianna Fáil saying that. That had come from other quarters as well.
But the annoyance was coming from the fact that in the document in black and white was that the UK couldn't unilaterally withdraw from it. It has to be done with agreement. That was the issue that was causing the concern, not the commentary by Leo Varadkar. So that, I mean, let's put it all in perspective.
Let me read this tweet. I want to move on. Senator Neil Richmond from Fine Gael has tweeted us, and he says, unreal to hear Lisa Chambers bemoan the government's Brexit language when she herself said this was a bad deal for the UK. Has she contacted the 12 Lib Dems to ask them to vote for the deal? Are they not Fianna Fáil's sister party?
There was a comment to say Neil Richmond himself had made the same assessment 2 days previous. So I think Senator Richmond likes to be active on Twitter towards me, but that's a matter of...
Let me ask the Minister, because they now in the Tory party will have to weigh up, should we move against Theresa May? And if we do, and if we get a new leader, what is the chance of renegotiating any element of this deal? Is the message from the Dublin government and Brussels, Minister Joe McHugh, that any renegotiation is out, out, out?
There's a blast from the past.
A blast from the past, Cormac. Look, I'm finding it difficult to get in here because I'm not in the studio, so apologies for that, and I can't see the interaction there around the table. But can I just say, in response to a number of issues that were raised there, we're at a very, very serious juncture in terms of our own Irish strategic interest, in terms of a relationship north and south, in terms of a relationship with the unionist community in Northern Ireland. And I re-emphasise again, within this agreement, there's no negative impact in terms of the constitutional status, the principle of consent. The consent is still there, and also the relationship between the United Kingdom and Ireland, a very, very strong relationship. And what I would ask at a personal level, Lisa, is this: we have to continue with the united front that we've been doing. And Simon Coveney, who I spoke to this morning, you've been briefed every step of the way, as all the opposition spokespersons, and I would appeal that we remain united in ensuring that we show conviction.
Okay, I want to move on from that, answer my question if you don't mind, and I know you're at a disadvantage there being at a remove, but any renegotiation of the deal put forward during the week, is that out?
Well, look, the deal that's presented to us, that's the deal that Westminster will be voting on in 3 weeks' time. So what happens between now and 3 weeks is a matter for the British government. What happens, be it in the Labour Party or any other parties, or the Conservative Party,
makes
and
no
that
difference.
Has to be respected. The respect here is for a sovereign nation, for them making their own independent choices, and they have to be given the time, and Theresa May certainly has to be given the respect.
Basically, you're telling the Tories.
She has shown respect for her commitments, and she's honoured her commitments that she made in September and December of 2017 and March of this year in relation to the no hard border on the island of Ireland.
But you're telling the Tories you can choose a new leader if you like. You can choose a new leader if you like, but the deal you'll be voting on is a deal that you got during the week.
As far as I'm concerned, this is a deal between the 27 European Union members and the United Kingdom. It's got cabinet approval at a British level, but obviously it has to go through the parliaments now. And that won't happen until after the summit in Europe, and it won't happen until the first week in December. So a week's a long time in politics. Certainly 3 weeks is going to be a very interesting space.
That's for sure. I think that's the one thing we can be sure of. I will say this in terms of the discussion we've just been having about the government's reaction to the agreement, and I think to some extent it's really a phony war, because we're just talking about the communication around and the messaging around the government's response. And I think one thing that's perhaps been missed is that while tone is very important, and clearly, you know, a quiet welcome and sort of relief and satisfaction would have been, I think, the appropriate tone, and for the most part I think it was, but I think we also do owe something to the EU, so we need to look not only at our relationship with Britain, which is what's been focused upon here, but also our relationship with the other 26 member states, because the negotiations on behalf of the EU27, of which Ireland of course is one, led by Michel Barnier, has been very respectful of Irish concerns, and certainly the protocol and the...
They owed us one, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Well, I think they did, but I think they stood firm with us and there was solidarity with us, and I think the government, and indeed Irish people generally, were entitled to feel some satisfaction about that and some relief about that. But I do think tone is important in this, and I think that's really what we've been talking about, but we can't rule out substance
as
well.
And I think maybe because it threatened the union, not because of our concerns.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
I mean, it was a mutual thing for sure.
They were quite happy to shaft Ireland when Ireland threatened the union. Ireland in 2010, when we were bounced into a bailout, they were more than happy to shaft us.
Well, I think all the more reason now why there's calls to feel satisfaction.
Well, they bounced into a bailout. We've been over this before. The Irish government was broke in November. This is not a bailout conversation, but this idea of bouncing into the bailout is just like, it's only a complete one-sided view of what happened at the time.
But anyway, without going back,
this is not
back,
being a
Gary,
Euro, a Euro
briefings
affiliate.
Didn't happen, Gary,
without,
you know,
without no. going back over the past, can I just say one thing that we haven't really focused on either is the prospect of the second referendum, which I think one can rule out too swiftly. There is a growing support for it across MPs of different parties. I know certainly any chance I get, or any chance my Labour colleagues here get with British Labour politicians, we make that point.
But a referendum on what?
We've seen on the terms of the deal or no deal. I mean, that remains to be seen. But
that would be a close referendum, and the division would go on. The big problem,
Gary, I think one can see this, that, you know, while the 29th March deadline is looming, clearly that could be extended if there was a case made for it.
Yeah.
Yes. exactly. If there was a case made for it, and a case being made by the British government on the basis they were proposing to put a referendum, would clearly be
a really
one
positive aspect to the deal. It's written into the deal, into the treaty. If it gets across the line, is the possibility acknowledged by both sides that a transition extension might be needed? So, okay, they're saying they want to get to the end of 2020 with the transition period, but both sides have kind of acknowledged that negotiations of future trade will probably take a lot longer than that, and there's facility there to extend the transition period further than 2020.
I think it'd be
that's very positive, especially for business communities, for farming.
That's all speculation at this point, but can I ask the Minister before we move on, because let me read this text first of all. Arlene Foster's attitude towards business in the North tells everything about the Brexit mentality. Get out quick and plan everything afterwards, even if it's too late or even if it's a disaster. Theresa May should get the Victoria Cross for bravery, says one texter. But Minister, your constituents in Donegal must at this stage be extremely worried about the erection of a hard border. Can you give them any clarity at this point as to how prepared the Irish state is in terms of putting up posts and customs officers on the border again?
Well, look, from day one, the people of Donegal and people living along the border and other Irish citizens in the different counties were very, very insistent and clear in saying we can't go back to a hard border. So that was the first thing. The second thing to say in relation to this vote that will be taken in Westminster, if this goes down as a no deal, it will put us in a very, very difficult position. I'm not going to speculate around that, but what I will say is what we have been doing is putting in provisions for that eventuality. But that is just speculation in the event of a no-deal scenario. We're working very, very much on the agenda that we will get this.
Sounds like you're telling your constituents there will be a hard border.
I mean, that's been ruled out completely time and time again by the government. But the truth of the matter is, Joe, as you know, and I know, that's not
going to happen.
Like, the government on one hand says, it keeps saying it's preparing for every eventuality, but yet not a north-south, not the border returning on the island of Ireland. So which is it? Like, you either are preparing for every eventuality or you're not.
We're edging towards the cliff, Minister. This is the second week in a row in this programme where a minister of your government has drawn back on telling us exactly what the preparations are around the border. Surely it's time for clarity.
We've been told that opposition parties have been briefed Can I get in there a second?
Yeah, look, we've had a number of sectoral meetings, a number of engagements, both north and south, and the message is quite clear across the border, each side of the border, that a physical hard border just cannot work. So as far as I'm concerned, as far as the government's concerned, there will be no hard border. There will be no technologies along the land border.
Even if there's no deal.
That's the space we're working in. Well, look, I'm not anticipating a no deal. I'm confident that within the next three weeks, things will change in terms of people's opinions, in terms of people's attitude, and certainly the debate. And can I also say as well, we have a deal in relation to the technical aspects, but there's still a long way to go in terms of the future relationship.
Okay.
And there's a lot of debate and issues that need to be addressed there. So there will be extra issues raised.
Look, Minister, I want to move on and take an ad break, and we'll discuss a topic close to your heart, possibly a decade of Fine Gael power after the break.
Email saturday@rte.ie. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
51551, I'm with Minister Joe... Well, I'm not with Minister Joe McHugh. He's out in the Siberia. He's in the lovely surroundings of City West at the Fine Gael Ardèche. I am with Lisa Chambers of Fianna Fáil, Ivana Bacic of Labour, Professor Gary Murphy of DCU and Daniel McConnell of the Irish Examiner. You're heading for nearly 10 years. If you win the next election, Joe McHugh, you'll be heading for... 8 years next February of Fine Gael power. What have the Romans ever done for us, Fine Gael supporters say? You're in bullish form out there, aren't you?
Well, just to, for the listeners, I can see you now, Cormac. So I can get eye contact with a video now in the van here, thanks
My
to Dave.
Cripes, I forgot that, yeah.
Yeah, we're in government since 2011, and I remember becoming a minister for the first time in 2014, and I remember going into budget negotiations for the 2015 budget, and the increases in my Gaeltacht budget was quite minimal. To give you an extent of how far we had to come. So that was 3 years ago. We're now only this year in a position to balance our budget for the first time since we came into power in 2011. And that has been a disadvantage in terms of doing all the things that we'd like to do. But what we did over the past 18 months, we've worked on a project plan, a national development plan for 10 years, the Project 2040, to look at what we can do in the long term. There's a lot of work going into that, a lot of intergovernment, a lot of interdepartment work, and that's the space we find ourselves in, is to ensure we don't go back to the place we were, where mothers were saying goodbye to their children, going to Canada and Australia, going back to a period when I was Director of Elections in 2010 in Donegal, where people, you could see fear in people's eyes, wondering would they have a job the next morning, would they have money in their pockets, would nurses get paid, would teachers get paid. That's the space we were in, and it's important that we don't forget where we've come from,
and that's
order to ensure that these don't happen again.
That's why you feel bullish enough to tell Fianna Fáil from your Ardesh, look, get on with these talks because we're not afraid of an election. Isn't that right?
Well, look, there'll be no election before Christmas. We're all, and Natisha has said that today, we don't know when the election will be. In fairness to some of the media colleagues maybe around the table there as well, there were speculation at the beginning of this government that the government wouldn't last to Christmas. So we've been in election mode since the first 6 months, and maybe that's why there's a constant talk about elections. But as far as we're concerned, there's negotiations going on. I'm not privy to those negotiations between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, but there is an emphasis to ensure that we get some sort of conclusion.
Yeah,
to
but
that
how I know that. Let me go to the academics and the hacks before I go to the politicians again on this one, because Daniel, the narrative has grown that Fine Gael wants an election, but they're stymied a little bit by Brexit, and Fianna Fáil are afraid of one at this stage. Is that right?
There's two elements.
Come on now,
there's certainly
trying to goad me here in the studio.
There are certainly enough in Fine Gael who would not mind an election anytime soon, because they've been essentially been on election footing since the Francis Fitzgerald episode last year. Posters are printed, you know, selection conventions are pretty much all but done. You know, so they're running at the candidates. The whole tone of the Fine Gael Ardesh this weekend is an election Ardesh without question. There's no doubt about it. The one flip side that has me kind of slightly circumspect about Fine Gael rushing to the polls is that, you know, they have a parliamentary, they've 49 TDs in the Dáil, and almost half of them, if not over half of them, are either in ministerial office or have a committee chairmanship.
They'll 29 out of 40.
Yeah,
40,
they will not get that anytime soon. If they go into coalition with anybody, they're going to lose a huge chunk of those jobs. You know, so Leo Varadkar has a charmed existence at the moment. He's an awful lot of jobs to give out and keep an awful lot of people sweet.
35% in the last sort.
They are. The economy is running well, but they are huge, like, they're huge deficiencies. They're, like, they have little or nothing to show for 8 years in government in relation to the health service. They've little or nothing to show in terms of housing.
But they would say, you heard Joe McHugh himself, regain sovereignty after the Troika, full employment. The party is creeping towards 40% in opinion polling.
Which shows that the economy is the overriding issue that will determine the success or failure at a general
the
election.
The abortion referendum, Gary, the same-sex marriage referendum, they'll point to an awful lot in an election, won't they?
Yeah, they probably will, but I mean, abortion has never been much of a factor when it comes to general elections, and I don't think it'll be any. Look what happened to poor Labour in 2016 after the great triumph of the same-sex marriage referendum. But if you want one reason why Fianna Fáil is suspicious of Fine Gael, you only have to look at the Taoiseach's tweet on Wednesday night of himself, Simon Coveney, Helen McEntee, and their political advisers looking smug out in some big office in Leinster House. And you can see
the situation room,
and you can see what the problem for Fianna Fáil is, that it's signing up to 2020 does really nothing for Fianna Fáil. It just ties them in to 15, 18 more months of being out of power. And that is a huge difficulty for Fianna Fáil. I think Fine Gael has a lot to point to, but if you asked anyone on the streets today, going to the game, what are the two big issues in Irish politics? Health and housing. And they haven't been solved. Sure. And they will be the two dominant issues come the general
and
election.
People, Lisa Chambers, don't give a stuff if it's Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. They want the country sorted. It doesn't matter who does it. Isn't that correct?
Well, obviously, citizens want the country to be run well and for their lives to be, you know, good and to have good access to healthcare, to housing, to broadband, all of the key issues that Gary has identified. But I think, you know, clearly all of the talk of an election is coming from Fine Gael. It's not coming from Fianna Fáil. I am a little bit constrained in terms of what I can say. I am a member of the negotiation team for Fianna Fáil in the confidence and supply talks, so I can't go into detail about the actual talks because we have given a commitment.
Because nothing's happening.
Could there be actually,
what I will say is there a lot is happening, but I can't go into detail because we've given a commitment that we will keep that confidential. So I'm a little bit constrained in that regard. But I don't understand what the pressure is. You know, we gave stability in 2016. We entered into negotiations when other parties ran for the hills. We did so without taking any of the 29 ministerial positions that Danny has pointed out. They have 29 ministers out of 49 TDs. We have 45 TDs, just
why
four behind.
You were offered the last round.
First of all, I'm not going to
had a grand coalition.
You had the 50-50 split and a rotating
I'm not going to go back over.
You'll answer it. Are you looking for any ministerial post this time or any position of power at all or influence this time?
Right now, we are in the process of reviewing the last 2.5 years. And I would ask the question, why are Fine Gael so tetchy, so panicky about reviewing their term in government over the last 2.5 years? It's written into the agreement in black and white. Leo Varadkar negotiated that agreement in 2016. There will be a review after the third budget. We are sticking to that.
Yeah, but they'll say they're not touchy. Answer that.
Well, I mean, when you see Charlie Flanagan this morning, the posters aren't printed, but the printers are oiled. And we need to get this moving along. Fine Gael are absolutely edging for election. They want an election. Micheál Martin wrote to the Taoiseach and said we should not instigate any election from either party until Brexit is finished. We haven't even gotten a response to that letter. So we've offered stability to get through Brexit because we recognise it is the biggest threat to our country.
Joe McHugh,
and there should be stability in the country to get through Brexit. Yeah.
Minister
the Taoiseach hasn't
McHugh
responded
is going
to that letter.
Reiterate
maybe,
that
maybe, 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 Joe, maybe, maybe Minister yeah. McHugh can respond as to why the Taoiseach hasn't taken up the offer to give our country stability until Brexit is finalised. Why is that, Joe?
Well, there was a first question or proposition thrown out that were tetchy. I haven't met any tetchy people out of the 2,500 people attending the Ardesh here.
They must all be very happy.
They're not tetchy with you, Minister.
Secondly, I'll go
when I'm out of the van. I'll go and try and find a few. But Kabir, the question in relation to the letters and the correspondence. Look, the Taoiseach wrote to the leader, leader Fianna Fáil, Micheál Martin, last summer, the end of last August.
He did, so and look, Micheál Martin actually replied to that.
He did, and
but
both
your leader
very publicly
hasn't replied to our letter.
Let him respond because there's a delay. Yeah,
but that was a request to do these negotiations before the budget. That didn't happen. We accepted that. We moved on. We still want to talk. We want to get this done. Look, the people of Ireland are not interested in wee games and that goes on between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. They want to have stability. They want to have certainty. And it's important that this conference supply agreement is done as quickly as possible. And I wish Lisa and her team well. And I know
The people of Ireland and the people who text this programme in particular are interested in how the problems facing our society, like housing, like homelessness and like health, are resolved. And time and again when people talk about Fine Gael, again last night, for example, on the Late Late Show, Glenn Hansard, he mentioned the word ideology. And it is Fine Gael's political ideology to leave it to the market. Now, I don't know if that's true, but that's what people say time and again. Is there any truth in that at all? Panel.
I think it's pretty clear that traditionally there's almost no difference ideologically between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on economic issues particularly, and the reality is that in the 2 years since 2016 that Fine Gael have been in government in the current arrangement of new politics, minority government, where everybody's on an election footing all the time, of course, notwithstanding confidence and supply, but over those 2 years where we have seen the economy do well, we've seen a really absolutely terrible failure by the government to address those two core issues of housing and of healthcare, despite the fact that we have an agreed all-party plan for the future of healthcare reform in Ireland, namely the Sláinte Care plan, and despite the fact that many parties, and Labour have put forward, for example, a very strong housing policy on the sort of radical measures that could be taken to deliver the numbers of social and affordable housing units that are ready, that are so sorely needed. But instead of that sort of radical proposals, instead of plans that have cross-party support being adopted by the government, for which I think they would receive support from across the houses, we've seen just a failure to tackle those two big issues, and I think that's what this government
would
be judged on.
But hang on, Daniel, because Minister Regina Doherty was on with Sean O'Rourke, I think, yesterday, and she was waxing lyrical about her 20 billion or so budget in social welfare and investing heavily in public services, and she said, I think at one point, not usually what Fine Gael would do. I mean, has Fine Gael changed its ideology to a certain extent?
Oh, I wouldn't necessarily go along with that, because I mean, when you look at the housing issue, you look at the role of county councils, you look at the role of the failure to bring social housing voids back in, particularly in the Dublin City area, back on stream since 2014. There has been a huge over-reliance in relation to the private sector to try and resolve
this
issue.
That's an ideological decision,
But again, you probably would look at you look at what the system that they've inherited, you know, most local authorities had either down tools in relation to, literally down tools in terms of their house building programmes. They don't have the expertise anymore, and, you know, the time it has taken to get up to speed has been remarkably slow.
But, like, what has Fine Gael's response to all of that been? So when it comes to housing, the Taoiseach tried to blame the local authorities. It was their fault it wasn't being delivered.
Well, I'm not here
when
to
could be pushing further on this when it comes as to, the confidence
when
and supply
it comes to health, the most recent comment from the Taoiseach, the doctors and nurses aren't working hard enough over the Christmas period.
Which is not when it comes a point
to other
there,
when it comes to other failures in delivery, it's always somebody else's fault. And Cormac, you made the point. They're coming up on 8 years now in government, looking at maybe a decade in power, if they got to push till 2020. But it's always somebody else's fault in terms of delivery. Delivery has always been the issue.
Currently,
you have to stand over.
If you're doling out fault, the fault of Fine Gael power is Labour and Fianna Fáil.
I think you have to stand over your own record. If you're coming up on 8 years and housing and health are where they are at now, and you start blaming doctors and nurses for the health issue, and you start blaming local authorities for housing, you know, that just smacks
at trying to do that. I do think Fianna Fáil could have done more to push the government on housing in the last budget. I think there's a failure there too.
We have brought forward a lot of opposition.
I always think it's a touch ironic when those on the left, and I think Mr. Hansard would accept that he's on the left, criticise Fine Gael for having an ideology which is on the centre right. I mean, it always makes me somewhat laugh if this is somehow a bad thing. The electorate have decided to give Fine Gael in and around 30%. Well, they obviously dropped to 27% at the last election. And I think there is a market for that position in Irish politics. It's not a far right. It's not even in mid right. It's kind of like the, if you had a 1 to 20 scale, maybe it's about 8 or 9. Fianna Fáil slightly to the left and Labour as you go left. And I think that's a reasonable position to hold. I think the problem for Fine Gael is that the people are getting upset with the fact that of the lack of progress. And I would also point to things like education. We see a housing problem there. I mean, the university is having a big problem with, you know, people
students
coming from Mayo, from Galway, wherever, to Dublin. So it's a much wider issue than simply a homeless. Do we have a housing problem per se?
But can I say on ideology, I don't think there's much to choose between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Policy, on economic ideology, nothing to choose between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. I think where Fianna Fáil have a real difficulty, however, is that they're being seen as increasingly outdated, with a few honourable exceptions like Lisa, on social issues, where Fine Gael have sensed the mood of the party, have moved as we indeed pushed them to move on marriage equality in 2015 from the Labour side, but then on the Eighth Amendment referendum this year. And Fianna, well, I don't know. I think it creates an impression of an outdated party that's behind the times.
Joe McHugh.
Look, ideological debates are really important. They're important to have. It's important to have this debate. But what's happening, the evidence on the ground is, take, for example, my own county, which is a big construction county. A lot of our plasterers, a lot of our builders, a lot of our construction workers who have been in London, they've been in Australia, they've been in Canada. A lot of them are still there, unfortunately, but obviously a lot of them have come back home. So a lot of work has gone on. Owen Murphy has put together a plan, and the two challenges in anything to do with building houses is supply and time.
And this
plan will work, but unfortunately they're not in the houses today.
Minister, we haven't seen the
plan
delivery.
Is working. Look, the Minister is telling us a lot done, more to do. We'll talk gender equality and gender quotas after the break.
Text 51551. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back to the programme. An awful lot of talk about the government plan that was announced during the week to create a certain quota of professorial positions solely for women. Now, Ivana Bacic, is that the right way to go, in your opinion, to end the inequality in that regard?
Well, it's not the only thing. Clearly, there's a whole raft of package of measures that needs to be adopted to address ongoing gender inequality in higher education and indeed elsewhere. I mean, you know, in politics, and I made the comparison during the week in a piece for The Independent, that in politics we had introduced a gender quota back in 2012 precisely because we could see that women were simply not getting selected through the political party machines as they were. I had done a report for the Justice Committee in 2009 where we got expert evidence to say that there are barriers holding women back in every career. We call them the four C's: lack of cash, lack of confidence, lack of childcare, and an old boy culture. And in politics, you had a fifth C of candidate selection procedures that were really actively working against women. So the quota now in place in politics requires each political party to run at least 30% of their candidates of each gender in each general election. And it's made a huge difference in the 2016 general
these
election.
Are women only
but just
roles,
to finish,
though.
Daniel, the numbers rose from 13% to 22% in the Dáil. So of
in
women.
One term.
So it's in one term. So yeah. A remarkable
you
achievement.
That's wrong,
so no, but can I just say this, Cormac, that I mean in higher education, therefore, I would see this announcement of very restrictive announcement, I must say, only in areas where women are significantly underrepresented. So it'll presumably only be in STEM subjects in maths and engineering, and only where other measures have been proven to have failed. Because there are quite stringent criteria that must be applied in order for these sort of posts to pass muster mm-hmm. under EU law, let alone from our own constitutional point of view. But I do support them as one measure, as part of a raft of measures, including challenging stereotypes more generally.
I would think the most obvious concern is that if you've got two candidates who are equally qualified to go going for a position, that one is immediately disenfranchised. I just think that's
These are separate posts set aside and outside of the normal rule. And I think anyone who thinks there isn't some sort of bias or isn't any hidden bias within the system should look at the Equality Officer ruling in Micheline Sheehy Skeffington's amazingly courageous case against NUI Galway, where they were able to forensically show how women were
getting
promotions.
She herself questioned the merit of this type of a quota during the week as well, didn't she?
I think she's welcomed in principle, this idea.
These are blunt instruments and they're deeply uncomfortable to try and have to implement. But are they necessary? Absolutely. It will take us another 20 years at the current rate just to hit 40%. That's how slow a snail's pace it is. And I think the political example that Ivana has just given shows you the difference, 13% to 22% in one term. We've had almost 400 years in this country of university education. We have yet to see a female president in a university in this country.
Maybe if you change the underlying difficulties or problems that people face coming up through the ranks.
I think,
flexible working hours and
so on. It needs to be part of a whole suite of measures. And you mentioned flexible working hours. On Thursday in the Dáil, myself and Fiona Loughlin, Deputy Fiona Loughlin, introduced a bill in the House around maternity leave, that we think there should be flexibility that both parents can share that. So, for example, if the mother doesn't want to take the full 6 months, or if she's self-employed and can't take maternity leave, the government rejected this bill, okay? My point is that Regina Doherty, the Minister for Social Protection, told me that she is ideologically opposed to the bill. This bill was only to cater for situations where women either can't take maternity leave because they're running their own business or in higher levels of academia and want to get back to work a bit sooner. So these are practical measures.
Get a response from Joe McHugh on that. Ideologically opposed to that. Some people have pointed to exactly that. That's what we need. That's what people say, Joe McHugh. What's wrong with it?
Yeah, and Regina's showing the lead in that regard as well. We're going to be looking at our own government legislation on that matter. So obviously there's a debate required. Can I just say I'd like to applaud Mary Mitchell O'Connor. Mary Mitchell O'Connor has taken a bold step here in introducing this, and she's obviously tested it and she's got advice. She's got AG's advice at a European level as well. And I think we need to do something. And I see it across the board where there's young women coming up through the ranks, and there's even looking out of the Ardèche here today, the number of female speakers and the calibre of female speakers who will be candidates in the next general election. And I think the 30% quota within in legislation has helped to create that culture,
Cormac,
that there is a pathway.
Can I come back in on that? I
think for
a young woman going for a position, and as Danny's pointed out, two candidates, both equally qualified, the person that's looking to hire one of those individuals, looking at a woman that is of childbearing age, is thinking, well, she's probably likely to take maternity leave and he definitely won't. And that's why
we're
the bill...
certainly not thinking about that at DCU. I can tell you that for a fact.
Well, my point is that we know there's a 14% gender pay gap. We know there's a deficiency in terms of female representation in politics and academia. The shared maternity bill that was put before the House on Thursday would have actually broken that, playing field.
I think, in fact,
would have allowed employers to say, well, actually, maybe the dad might take maternity leave. Fine Gael opposed that. And Joe McHugh hasn't answered the question.
One of the big difficulties for me is that I'm way out of time. I'm so sorry. So my thanks to Minister Joe McHugh, Lisa Chambers, Ivana Bacik, Professor Gary Murphy, Daniel McConnell, and earlier John Rintoul of The Independent in London. Sinead Bumjadash. Well, let's see what next week brings. We'll be back next Saturday at 1 o'clock. Good evening, Slán.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara was produced by Penny Hart. Research was by AB Film and Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan, and Dave Gibson was on sound.